Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The longest government shutdown in U.S. history has ended. On Monday night, 8 Senate Democrats joined Republicans to pass a bill to end the shutdown. Last night, 6 House Democrats broke ranks in joining all but 2 Republicans to close the deal. Until Monday, Democrats refused to budge until Republicans agreed to extend subsidies for the Affordable Care Act. Healthcare premiums are expected to increase by as much as $500 a month or more for 24 million people if Republicans continue to budge. We will find out why these costs are so high in the second half of the show. We'll begin by discussing SNAP. 42 million Americans will finally receive their SNAP benefits. We're talking about low-paid workers, children, people with disabilities, and veterans. Over the past few weeks, the Trump administration has fought rulings to use contingency funds to pay for benefits, leaving millions in limbo and food banks scrambling to meet demand. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and Los Angeles Times columnist Michael Hiltzik says the GOP's refusal to fund food stamps during the shutdown shows how little the party cares about the economically vulnerable. In this government, men, women, and children on the edge of hunger are merely pawns in a partisan campaign. Michael Hiltzik is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and business columnist with the Los Angeles Times. His latest book is called Golden State, The Making of California. Hi, Michael. Thanks so much for your work and thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Rose.
We're also joined by Joel Berg, CEO of Hunger Free America, a national nonprofit working to end hunger and ensure everyone has sufficient access to nutritious food. Joel Berg is author of All You Can Eat, How Hungry is America? Hi, Joel. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. I wish this was under better circumstances.
I agree. And Joel, let's start off with you, because this issue has gotten so much media coverage. 42 million people are on SNAP. But what has missed from so much of that coverage is that in order to qualify for SNAP, you have to make a very low income and have hardly any assets. Can you tell us about that? Because that deserves so much more attention.
Yes. SNAP, as it's called in California, CalFresh, is really the last broad-based program that still exists for limited income Americans. The vast majority of people on the program, as you indicated, are low-paid workers, children, active-duty military personnel, senior citizens, veterans, and people with disabilities. So the stereotype of who gets SNAP and who needs SNAP are really ridiculously wrong. The largest group of people who receive SNAP are white. And that's important because the other side wants to demonize people on SNAP and imply it's the other, it's immigrants or non-white people. Just not true.
I'm looking at numbers from the National Council on Aging. If you live on your own, your net income has to be 100% of the poverty rate. We're talking about $1,300 a month in order to qualify for SNAP. For a family of four, net income, $2,680. Michael, these are such low incomes. The fact of the matter is almost half of the country really struggles to make ends meet. The Poor People's Campaign tries to get that out there. What are your thoughts about media coverage of that piece of this story?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that the media coverage has missed is how far back this assault on the well-being of the poorest of the poor has been going on. As I wrote last week, Republicans have been at war with this sort of assistance really since the 1930s when it first emerged. And the theme, as I think Joel alluded to, is that the people who receive this sort of relief are the undeserving poor. They demonize them as being lazy, as being able-bodied, but unwilling to work. We've heard GOP politicians talk about how basically SNAP benefits really are incentives for people not to work. We've heard Republican congressmen go on the air and say, look, they've made a choice. They've chosen to stay home and play video games because they know they can get fed. And of course, that really is just a slander. So I think that really is the context that often gets missed by the media coverage here.
Why is that the case, Michael? I mean, what a time to talk about the struggle to make ends meet, why wages are low, why people have to have multiple jobs in this country. Why is it so difficult to have that conversation? Because I listen to NPR pretty much nonstop, sometimes turn on the cable shows, read a lot of the major papers, and I just don't see or hear many conversations about why so many people struggle to make ends meet in this country.
I think part of the problem is that media, you know, whether it's NPR or the commercial broadcasting networks, basically want to play the middle, sort of the middle ground. They want to have Democrats on, and then they want to have Republicans on, and they treat the positions of these two parties as though they're somehow equivalent, and it's that we're just in an argument about how to interpret reality, but reality is just does not comply with that sort of political positioning. And you know, I think one thing that also got lost in the coverage of this really was a disaster for people who needed SNAP is basically that. You know, SNAP is just sort of a handout. And it's just, this is just untrue and unfair. So I think the coverage didn't, as Joel pointed out, it didn't show how strict SNAP's eligibility standards are. They really show that this program is directed at the poorest of the poor. And I think one thing also that got lost was the fact that if the Democrats were in charge of the government right now, if we had a Democrat in the White House and Democratic control of Congress and SNAP benefits were threatened by the shutdown, we would have seen politicians moving heaven and earth to make sure that there was no break in the delivery of assistance to this population. Instead, we had Republicans who were in control, and they were moving heaven and earth to avoid paying these benefits. And I think that is an image that should stick with people going forward over the next 2 or 3 years. It really was sort of a disgrace to see the administration and Congress doing what they could to avoid finding a way to pay these benefits. We've seen the Republican administration basically flout the laws on public finance going back to the inauguration of Trump on January 20th. And, you know, when it came to SNAP, they were doing everything they could to pretend that the law prevented them from paying these benefits. Clearly, that was not true. And it was really just repugnant to see this going on.
What about that piece of it, Joel? Because you have Donald Trump holding a Great Gatsby party at Mar-a-Lago over Halloween weekend, talking about the new gold White House and the makeover that has happened at the White House, and at the same time fighting every time a court says you must use contingency funds to pay for benefits. I mean, they took this all the way to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I agree. A big problem has been that the media has been treating this with false equivalency. We don't have to pretend today is Friday because some far right wing think tank may say today's Friday. Media can say, you know, the advocate says today's Thursday. And you know what? We looked it up on the calendar and he's right. And even the use of the old term food stamps, which hasn't been used for over a decade by so much of the media, frankly, betrays a class bias in the reporting, and the fact that the media, shows like this notwithstanding, used to have many people assigned to a poverty beat, and now there are thousands of people covering sports, thousands of people covering media, entertainment and business, but less than a handful of people who covered this issue full time. And so I do think this was a real learning curve for the media to understand the real lives of tens of millions of people that often do not get coverage on their airways or in their print.
Joel Berg is CEO of Hunger Free America and author of All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America? Michael Hiltzik is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and business columnist with the Los Angeles Times. One of Michael's latest pieces is the GOP says the, oh, that was about Obamacare, actually. He's got a piece about the GOP war on SNAP. And Joel has a piece in The Nation, Why Trump is Allowing Food Stamp Funding to Run Out. He says, I warned that Trump and congressional Republicans could use a shutdown to deny SNAP benefits, but was told there was no way our political system would allow that to occur. And that's exactly what was allowed to occur. If you have any questions or comments, if you are on SNAP, I know we've been doing so many shows about this over the last 6 or so weeks, and it's just been head spinning because on the one hand, people thought they were going to get benefits and then they didn't. And then depending on what city you lived in San Francisco, you got the benefits. But if you live in a different city close by, you did not. So if you have any questions or comments, stories to share, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. The other missing piece here that really should be talked about when we're discussing the fact that 42 million people are on SNAP and 140 million people are poor or low wealth, according to the Poor People's Campaign. And you both have written about this. Michael, in your column, you write, Republican hostility to SNAP coalesced in the drafting of the budget bill enacted this summer, which cut $187 billion from SNAP over 10 years. This is the largest cut to SNAP in history. About 4 million people could have their benefits cut substantially or eliminated altogether. So that's another piece of this story that deserves more attention.
Well, that's right. You know, the Republicans, as I wrote, have been at war with SNAP for decades and decades. They want to treat these people as undeserving, and they want to ignore the fact of how important SNAP is to recipients. Some years ago, I wrote about a debate in Congress in which a Republican congressman said, well, you know, we're going to cut SNAP because we're only going to cut a modest amount and we need to save money. And a lot of the congressmen who were talking this way were in there with both hands. They were getting crop benefits. They were they owned farms. They were getting all sorts of benefits from the federal government. And they weren't cutting that because they were the recipients. But they were pretending that allowing SNAP benefits to continue was somehow going to bankrupt the Republic. It's an old stunt. We hear it when they talk about cutting benefits for Social Security. We hear it when they talk about cutting Medicaid. We hear it when they talk about cutting Medicare. And it's all part of, as I said, this theme that the people who are on public relief, they're on it because of their own moral failings. Look, we know if you've lived that way, that it's often not your fault. You are basically a victim of circumstance. You are a victim of a U.S. financial economy that favors the wealthy and disfavors those who are really struggling to make ends meet. And I think it's true what you said and what Joel said, that this may be a wake-up call for Americans in understanding how important these programs are. And I think that is important.
And I do want to say that some of the cable shows had really important pieces focusing on people struggling, But the dots were rarely connected. CNN had a piece with Onita Morris. She makes $2,800 a month working full-time at the university in West Virginia. Half of it goes to rent. The rest goes to daycare and utilities, leaving her with $100 for other expenses like groceries. She said, "I went to college. I did all of the things they say you're supposed to do. I pulled myself up by my bootstraps." Joel, these are the stories that we just need to hear in this country, because a lot of people might not be aware about people struggling. Onita Morris working full time at a university in West Virginia, and yet she still struggles to feed her kids.
That's absolutely true. And I say to conservatives who oppose a SNAP, then for goodness sakes, why don't you increase the minimum wage? The vast majority of people receiving SNAP would prefer not to need the program. They would prefer to be able to earn enough working full time to feed their families. And we need to certainly make housing and health care affordable. We supported the fight to ensure that health care premiums would be reduced. You indicated that they could go up to by $500 a month minimum. That's $6,000 a year. If people have $6,000 a year to are forced to spend that on healthcare, that's $6,000 a year they have less on food. So this is truly the ultimate affordability issue. And so many people in their minds sort of, if I may say, ghettoize the hunger issue, have racial false beliefs, have class and gender false beliefs, and really equate hunger with the people panhandling outside a BART station or in a street corner, when in fact their mental image of who's hungry should be the home health care attendant. Should be the clerk at their coffee store. And that's who's really needing SNAP. So it's really a problem for our whole society, wage-wise and expenses-wise.
This is another important point, Joel, because the minimum wage has been stuck at $7.25 since 2009. This is the federal minimum wage. The Economic Policy Institute shows that in 20 states, the federal minimum wage has not moved. These are mostly Republican-controlled states in the South and the Midwest. And then in the other 30 states, minimum wages are higher. But again, the poor people in the South, I mean, it's great that California has higher wages, but what about people in the South who are still making $7.25 an hour or less if they work in restaurants?
Well, I'd say California also has a far higher cost of living. And so while adjusted for the cost of living, California actually has the highest poverty rate in the country.
Right.
And so while some progressives might love, Governor Newsom's snappy response to Trump, which is great, I think in the end, governance matters. And California not effectively addressing its affordability crisis, and that obviously not only increases hunger and food insecurity, but homelessness is a real problem. And if Democrats want to regain, or progressives or liberals, whatever you want to call them, want to regain the faith of the American people, they do need to govern better and not just address wages, but address the basic costs of living.
And Joel, it's such a good point, because in your latest Nation piece, you write that many elites, even liberal ones, really celebrated the supposed overall health of the economy while ignoring the struggling, Americans struggling to make ends meet. These same economic cheerleaders then scratched their heads when people voted against the Democratic administration and they lost the election, or people just didn't vote. I mean, 90 million people did not vote. And this was connected to that.
You can't eat the GMP, right? And elites focus on the stock market. They focus on vague ideas like the gross national product or economic growth or even the unemployment rate, not focusing on wages, not focusing on the cost of living. And the last election was supposed to be a vibe election, at least for the Democrats. And instead it was, what are you doing to improve my living situation election? And on that level, the Democrats essentially failed. They had some plans to address it, but certainly didn't communicate them effectively and convince people to either vote for them or to even get out of their house and vote. And unless you can convince people you're going to improve their lives in a very concrete, measurable way, you're not going to be able to win a governing majority.
Michael, to Joel's point about California, California's poverty rate is almost 18%. It is the highest in the United States alongside Louisiana. 7 million people in California lack the resources to meet their basic needs, according to the California Budget and Policy Center. And since Joel brought up Governor Newsom, I mean, he's all over the place doing national interviews. I noticed that the national hosts never really ask him about what is happening in California, let alone the high poverty rate. Have you interviewed him recently, or are you planning to?
I haven't interviewed the governor recently, and I would love to do it again. But the fact of the matter is, I think Joel is absolutely correct, and you're correct. The cost of living in California is exceptionally high, and the reason for the level of poverty and the high cost of living basically has much to do, if not almost everything to do, with the cost of housing in California, particularly in the coastal zone. That's San Francisco to Los Angeles to San Diego and all those places in between. There's a lot of demand for housing, and we simply have not done enough to meet that demand. And in part, that's because everybody who's moved, or people who moved to California, want to keep California the way it was when they moved here, which was a lovely place, not particularly overcrowded. And of course, it got overcrowded, and the demand for housing, particularly housing that's within commuting distance of a job, is overwhelming. So I think that's true. I don't think Newsom has done enough to meet that, but he's done more than has been done in many other states. So I don't mean to defend him, but that is the reality in California, is that the cost of living, particularly in the most demanding communities or the most demanded communities, is very, very high. And the dearth of affordable housing is exceptionally high.
Hmm. Well, we have a few emails. Leslie writes, I've recently seen a TV ad from Amazon saying their average wage is $23 an hour. Who and where can a person live on $23 an hour? Philip writes, somehow the left is not reaching the people who could benefit the most from freeing themselves from right-wing reactionary propaganda and who vote against their own best interests. Better messaging is clearly needed. Do your guests have any ideas? Well, Joel, I mean, the Democrats are all over the board on issues that would actually help people who are struggling to make ends meet. I mean, well, Joe Manchin's not in D.C. anymore, but you have Joe Manchin, you've got Bernie Sanders, now you have Zora Mamdani. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, Hunger Free America is a nonpartisan group, so we don't take sides in elections. But to the degree any party took my advice, you have to be crystal clear and consistent. I just don't understand the few Democrats in the Senate who voted for 6 weeks to create the shutdown, and then when the Democrats were winning, ended the shutdown. It would have been a reasonable position 6 weeks ago to say, let's not do this. The suffering will be too great. Or it would have been a reasonable position to say, let's finish the job. You don't turn around halfway after invading, you know, Normandy. But the position seven of them took, now neither of the two senators from California, that, we let 42 million people go without food, but now we're going to cave, makes very little sense. It really was the worst of both worlds from both a substantive standpoint and a messaging standpoint.
I also just want to mention, because so much is going on and it's hard to keep up, in your piece for The Nation, Joel, you write that in addition to the Trump administration taking this to the Supreme Court rather than funding SNAP, they canceled more than 84 million pounds of food aid scheduled to be distributed by charities. They also ended the USDA's 27-year practice of collecting and publishing food insecurity data. This is basically people who struggle to put enough food on the table. And this is data that we all need. I mean, you, reporters, why did they end this?
They ended it because they want to make us North Korea, where the government eliminates any facts, any reality that goes against the governing regime. So that is just the unfortunate reality of where they are. And they fully engaged in cruelty. And the Democrats' biggest mistake was just not allowing themselves to believe that the Republicans would be as reckless and cruel as they were. As they said, the ostrich approach to governing doesn't work. If you can't measure something, you can't address it.
Michael, your final thoughts. Where do we go from here, given that so many people are struggling now to keep up with housing costs so high and the cost of living so high, and so many people struggling to make ends meet? Where do we go from here?
Well, I think we're facing a real political, we can call it a partisan inflection point. When the Democrats crossed the aisle, so to speak, and agreed to end the shutdown, basically they were setting up the next battle. And the next battle, we are already seeing it, is going to be over the cost of healthcare. And I think we have to recognize that the Democratic Party since the 1930s really has done the most to alleviate the struggles, the vicissitudes and risks of life, as FDR put it, for the great mass of people, for ordinary Americans. But they have been unbelievably bad at communicating what their policies are and what their goal is. The Democrats gave us Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid. They gave us the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, but somehow they allowed Republicans to define these programs in the most negative way possible. Now, what we're going to see over the next month or two is going to be the chickens are going to come home to roost for the Republicans. The spike in premiums for ACA plans that we are going to see if the Republicans do not vote to continue the subsidies that are necessary to make these plans affordable, that's going to be on them. And it's going to be in front of everybody, the average Americans, sitting at their kitchen table and trying to cost out what they can spend money on if their healthcare premiums, $500, I think, is a low estimate of how much these premiums are going to spike. If you are older, you're going to be paying thousands of dollars more for healthcare. If you can afford it, you are going to have to make decisions about where you're going to put the disposable income that you have, whether you're going to pay the rent or put food on the table or get healthcare. And God forbid you actually have a health crisis. Without these subsidies, people are going to give up. They're going to be forced to give up their insurance. They're going to face enormous risk. They're going to have to go into medical debt by the millions of people. We are going to see that. We're going to see that become a huge political issue. And we can only hope that the Democrats can get the message out as to whose fault that is. It's not going to be their fault so much. It's going to be the GOP's fault. And hopefully the lesson will be learned by the average voters. I think we're already seeing that. We saw it on Tuesday. We're going to be seeing it more in the months and quarters to come.
And let me just quickly add, anyone who needs help or can give help, please go to hungerfreeamerica.org. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. Michael Hiltzik is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, business columnist with the LA Times. His latest book is Golden State, The Making of California. Joel Berg is CEO of Hunger Free America and author of All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America? Joel and Michael, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And just a little more news about the end of the government shutdown. It could take up to 2 weeks for the 20 Head Start early childhood programs that were forced to close during the shutdown to come back online, according to the New York Times. Representatives of the airline industry say it'll take about a week for air travel to return to normal. Also, Representative Adelita Gravalia, Democrat of Arizona, was sworn into office 7 weeks after she won a special election to fill a seat left vacant by the death of her father. She says Republican Speaker Mike Johnson refused to swear her in during the government shutdown because of the Epstein files. Representative Gravalva became the decisive member to sign the Epstein discharge petition after Johnson swore her in. That means the House will now have to vote on disclosing the Epstein files next week. Yesterday, the House Oversight Committee released 20,000 pages of Epstein-related documents. Some of those emails are just wild. Trump is named 1,500 times in those documents, according to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Coming up after a break, we will talk about why healthcare costs are so high in this country. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we're going to talk about why healthcare costs are so high. The overwhelming majority of Democrats in the Senate and House, well, really all of them, say that they took part in this government shutdown to force Republicans to extend tax credits for the Affordable Care Act. If Republicans refuse to budge, monthly premiums will increase by $500 a month or more. So why is this? And will we ever see some kind of universal healthcare program in this country? Today, we're joined by Dr. Monica Maloof, a physician, associate professor of medicine, and associate program director for the internal medicine residency program at a large Chicago-based institution. Dr. Monica Maloof is also communications chair with Physicians for a National Health Program. They advocate for a universal, comprehensive, single-payer national health system. Hi, Dr. Maloof. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Wendell Potter spent many years as a public affairs executive for Humana and Cigna after witnessing firsthand how these corporations use PR and lobbying to tilt the scales toward corporate interests. Wendell Potter abandoned his corporate career to advocate for healthcare reform. He leads the Center for Health and Democracy and the Lower Out-of-Pocket Now Coalition. He's also publisher and executive director of Healthcare Uncovered and the author of four books, including the best-selling Deadly Spin. An insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. Hi, Wendell. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Rose. Thank you.
Well, great to have both of you. It's pretty shocking to think that premiums could increase by $500 a month, maybe $750 or more a month. Millions of people say they just will cancel their healthcare. Wendell, can you start us off? Why are these costs so high?
They're high because health insurance companies cannot, nor do they really want to control rising healthcare costs, because as healthcare costs go up, they just jack up their premiums. And before the Affordable Care Act, we had almost 50 million Americans who didn't have coverage. And to bring more people into coverage, the Affordable Care Act did create something called the ACA Marketplace, or Obamacare Marketplace, and the Congress authorized subsidies to be given to actually insurance companies to help people cover the cost of their premiums. Much of that will continue to go on, but during the pandemic, when President Biden was in office, the Democrats were able to enhance those subsidies. And that's what is expiring. These subsidies are expiring at the end of this year. And the Republicans are unwilling to extend them. Almost all the Democrats, as you said, were trying to get them extended. And that was at the center of the government shutdown. But it is at the end of the day, because we've largely turned over our healthcare system to big insurance companies that put profits over patients at every step of the way.
Dr. Maloof, what would you like to add? Given that you are a doctor, you see patients on a regular basis, you know how this system works. Why do these costs continue to increase?
Yeah, I think I'll echo a lot of what Wendell said. And I literally was in clinic this morning. I had a patient crying in my office, a cancer patient, because they were losing their insurance this year. And they weren't sure what to do next. This is a daily occurrence in my clinic. And it's because of the punchline is what Wendell said, is that our system prioritizes profits over patients. The U.S. healthcare system is built for insurance companies to dictate the playbook. Meanwhile, we are seeing hospitals across the country close their doors. We are seeing physicians quit healthcare altogether because of burnout and moral injury. And companies like United, CVS, Aetna are just raking in higher and higher profits each year. There's no legislation right now on the table from anybody except for the universal healthcare proposals, the Medicare for All bills, that really is aimed at fixing this, that is aimed at revamping our healthcare system. These subsidies are essential for the families that need them right now, and it's shocking to me that Republicans won't extend them, especially given the funding they've put forward for immigration enforcement, for ICE, for the border, but they won't fund health insurance for families that need it. Like, that to me is really shocking to the conscience.
Can you tell us a few more stories, Dr. Maloof? What you said about the cancer patient is just heartbreaking because I lost my dad to an aggressive form of cancer in January, and I'm so grateful to his union benefits. He was a sheet metal worker, so he had Medicare and an incredible supplement. And after he passed, I got the bills. I mean, some bills were $200,000. We didn't have to pay it because of his great insurance, but it made me think, if he were 50 and he didn't have Medicare, how would he have paid for any of this? How do people do it, especially with cancer rates on the rise?
Well, first off, I am so sorry for your loss and everything that you've had to go through. I know how difficult that can be for families.
Thank you.
Your question of how do people do it? The reality is they don't. My patients on a daily basis, I work outside of Chicago. I see hundreds of patients each month. And every day I have patients make the decision to prioritize rent over healthcare, to prioritize feeding their kids over picking up their medications. I recently had a patient who has a history of smoking, had some concerning findings on her lung scan. And when we see those concerning findings, sometimes our recommendation is that we get a CAT scan every 3 months. And so I told her, it's time for another CAT scan. And she said, I can't do it. I am still paying the bill from my last CAT scan. I have rent to pay and my car payments. And I'm not going to do another scan. And it was sort of this shocking moment to me. It's like, I'm telling you, you could have lung cancer. We need to follow up on this and catch it. And people literally cannot afford to do treatments, do basic recommendations from their physicians because of the position our current financial climate is putting them in, and because our healthcare system has just become so unaffordable to many Americans. There's data that comes out annually about this, that 40, up to 40, 50% of Americans avoid either picking up medications or doing treatments recommended by their doctors because of cost.
That is so devastating. There have been a lot of reports about what's happening in Mississippi because the Republicans there have refused to expand Medicaid. And NPR had a heartbreaking story about how pregnant women in Mississippi often do not see a doctor until they are 8 months along. And that is why, in many cases, the maternal mortality rate is so high. I mean, this is just shocking, Dr. Maloof, in a country with so much wealth that women are not going to the doctor until 8 months into a pregnancy.
Yeah, I did see that report. It's truly horrifying. For us as physicians, this was not new information because we know we have one of the worst maternal morbidity rates in developed countries across the globe. A lot of that has to do with racial inequities in our healthcare system, but also a big portion of that is access to care. And now we're really afraid in the medical community about what the cuts to Medicaid are going to do because more than 40%, so almost half of pregnant women in America, rely on Medicaid for health insurance coverage. And you can think about it, it makes sense. Most pregnant women are young, working women, and a lot of them can't get healthcare through other mechanisms, and they rely on Medicaid. And now we're seeing Medicaid cuts coming in aggressively. And what that's going to mean for women and our maternal mortality rates is just, it's terrifying to a lot of us in the healthcare community. We know we're really anticipating the worst. And this crisis that we're seeing in Mississippi, I think we're going to start to see versions of that unfold across the country.
Wendell, you worked at Cigna and Humana. You spent many years as a public affairs executive. You witnessed firsthand what goes on behind the scenes. The healthcare system is very complex. There's so much money at stake here. A Politico has a piece about the healthcare lobbying boom, and then a number of doctors wrote a piece in Stat called "The U.S. Experiment with Profit-Driven Healthcare Has Failed." They point out that between 2001 and 2022, healthcare corporations diverted at least 2.6 trillion, trillion with a T, from patient care to shareholder payouts. So given that CEO pay is so high, executive pay is high, the profits are obscene. How do you begin to drastically change this system?
It is difficult, and that explains why we don't have a universal healthcare system. We have not only enabled these companies to get bigger, but our political system enables big corporations to influence public policy and campaigns in ways we don't see elsewhere in the world. One of the things that my team and I did when I was at Cigna was dole out campaign contributions. One of the things that I want to try to get advocates to do is to pressure Democrats and Democratic candidates in particular, all candidates, to refuse to take their money. Because that study, that article you mentioned, is absolutely correct. I saw, and I do research of my own, over the past 10 years, just seven big for-profit corporations, two of which I work for, brought in over $10 trillion in revenue. Last year, they made over $70 billion in profits over 10 years. It's been $500 billion in profits. So it's been a massive money machine for these companies. And more recently, they've gotten deeper and deeper into healthcare delivery as they've changed their acquisition strategy. But I do see some evidence of not only people waking up to realizing how these companies have taken control of our healthcare system, but how they are affected by that. And they're getting worked up about it. And I think that we'll see in the next elections, and also as we look to 2028, things will change. I think we may be getting to the point, once again, that we will have a real conversation about what we need to do. And even Republicans are questioning the value of the health insurance industry as it is morphed into this behemoth that it really is.
Today, we're talking about healthcare in the United States. Why are these costs so high? Democrats decided to continue with the shutdown because they wanted Republicans to extend tax credits for the Affordable Care Act. And if the Republicans refuse to budge, premiums will go up by $500 a month or more. Millions of people say they just will not have health insurance because they cannot afford it. Today, we're joined by Wendell Potter, a former executive with the health insurance companies Humana and Cigna. He's now working for healthcare reform. He leads the Center for Health and Democracy, the Lower Out of Pocket Now Coalition. He's publisher of Healthcare Uncovered, author of many books, including the best-selling Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. Dr. Monica Maloof is a doctor, associate professor of medicine, and associate program director of the internal medicine residency program at a large Chicago-based institution. She is with Physicians for a National Health Program. They advocate for a universal, comprehensive, single-payer health insurance. I just want to share a quick story, because I think it's so important to compare the U.S. to other countries. I was in Italy several years ago, and I needed to see a doctor on the weekend. I saw a doctor. He gave me a prescription. The whole experience cost $20, and he didn't pay a cent to go to medical school. So you hear this in Europe. People are shocked that we have this kind of system. And I wonder, Dr. Maloof, given that you work with the Physicians for a National Health Program, what is it going to take? Because even in a state like California, where Democrats have a supermajority, they don't need a Republican vote to pass legislation. We did a show back in February 2022 about the California Guaranteed Health Care for All Act, and the bill would have provided comprehensive universal health care. But the assemblyman who was behind this, Ash Kalra, pulled the bill, saying he didn't have the votes for it to pass. But a lot of supporters said you should have forced the Democrats to go on record, but he didn't. And so Democrats have a supermajority in California, and yet we cannot get universal health care in this state. So what do you think it's going to take?
I think it's going to take all of us. We've seen this happen in Democratic states, as well as when Obama had a majority, or had leadership in when he was in the White House and had control over Congress and the Senate. To his credit, he brought all parties to the table and for months and deliberated and passed this behemoth of a bill, which is the Affordable Care Act. But I think what's infiltrated every single one of the discussions about healthcare in the United States is exactly what Wendell was alluding to, which is financial corporate interests. When you have massive behemoths that are financially invested in keeping the system the way it is, it's really, really, it's going to be really, really challenging to change that. There was an article that sort of shook me to my core about United Healthcare recently that was, United Healthcare, is it too big to fail? Because they've just become such a massive presence in the US in health industry right now. So I don't think that we can do this on a state-based level. I think this needs to be on a national level. I think we need to consider that the Democratic Party has, you know, there's shades of blue, and we need representatives who are truly committed to recognizing the need for universal health care to push this forward. We have a contingency of those. There's the Medicare for All bill in the House and in the Senate, the one in the House by Jayapal and the Senate by Bernie Sanders. And they've had a lot of co-signers. There is a decent amount of support. We just need really people to continue to champion those efforts. And I think it needs to come from grassroots engagement. So our organization is really about getting physicians and healthcare people's voices out there, of which we know that the majority of physicians do support this legislation, because we see on a daily basis, I shared some of those stories of what we witness, and we recognize the need for change. So I really think it's going to take efforts from across the United States. It needs to happen at a national level. It can't happen at the state-based level. It's also like people move. So if California passes universal health care and then you move to Kansas, like what happens then? We really need a comprehensive national system. And I can go on and on about why we deserve such a system and why we haven't had one yet.
And a lot of people, Dr. Maloof, wonder, if Medicare were extended, say, to 55-year-olds and then 45-year-olds going down the line, could the system handle it at this point? Because we need so much change. I mean, everybody's got an experience of, you know, wanting to see a doctor and it's going to take 6 months. It's just really hard right now to find a primary care doc and get appointments. There's so much needs to change with the system.
Yeah, I feel that reality as a primary care doctor. I'll tell you like a few things that I know. One is that we already ration healthcare in America. People are afraid of like waits and long wait times and getting into the doctor. But right now we ration healthcare based on socioeconomic status and not based on need. So people who have the money and can pay can get medical care, and people who can't won't. So when people say they're afraid, can the system handle it? Can it tolerate it? Well, we're already tolerating wait times and disparities and issues with access, but we tolerate them because it's happening to people who can't afford it. So we're already making that judgment call as a society. The second piece of this is we have trialed this in the past as a country. When the Affordable Care Act passed, tens of millions of people got healthcare access that did not have it before, and it did not overwhelm the system. The reason is because there is leeway. There are physicians who have time. There are more people who can see patients. There are some people who maybe can space their appointments out a little bit more and don't need to be seen as urgently. So we did not see a surge in wait times after the Affordable Care Act passed. So when we look at the data, we do not anticipate that, you know, expanding healthcare coverage will cripple the system.
Wendell, what would you say to people who are very concerned because their premiums are about to go up $500 or more a month and they just can't afford it?
You know, it's an impossible situation. What do you tell them? And as Monica said, you have people who are trying to make a decision of, do you pay for the groceries or pay for the rent or pay for your health insurance? And so it's an impossible dilemma that we're putting our citizens in. I would say join organizations that are pushing for healthcare reform. Clearly do what you can to avoid getting sick and getting injured, but we all know that that's not something that is within our control. But the reality is, undoubtedly, people are going to be losing their insurance and losing their access to care. People need, as Monica said, to be organized, and I do agree that I think that with grassroots efforts, and we saw at the end of last year, almost a year ago, this outpouring of outrage at the insurance industry. Sadly, it came after the death of one of the executives, but we saw then just how just under the surface this outrage is. And I've seen some survey research just recently that shows that people are just fed up with insurance companies. That's what the work that my team and I do is, to help people understand just how greedy these corporations are, how deeply they are in our lives, how they are really the gatekeepers to us getting the care that we need. And they're maximizing revenues and profits for the benefit of themselves and their shareholders. And I think more and more people, as they understand that, they're going to vote in ways that I think will change the political dynamic in this country. That's what we ultimately need at the end of the day, is a change in political structure and having members of Congress who will actually do what their constituents need.
And if you drill down, Wendell, the California Healthcare Foundation finds that 25 cents of every dollar in our health system, that's as much as $73 billion just in California, goes to red tape, paperwork, and administrative waste, excessive profits for companies, and then treating serious illnesses that could have been caught earlier or prevented altogether with basic primary care. I'm just so afraid of what this is going to mean for desperately needed preventative care. Because if you don't get preventative care, you could find out you have something devastating. And then, it could have been dealt with at least years in advance.
Exactly. And that's what we are subjecting our people to, not having access to even preventive care. And if you are uninsured, the cost of even getting preventive care can be more than you can afford. And what we do see is people avoiding getting the care that they need early on, getting preventive care, and getting treated when they might be able to be cured or their disease or condition ameliorated before it gets so serious that it results in hospitalization and premature death. That's what where we are in this country. To your point earlier, and we waste so much money on administrative costs and on profits. We could expand the Medicare program to cover everybody, because the money is already in the system. We just need to redirect it.
Mm. Well, we will continue this conversation because it is so important. Wendell Potter spent many years working for Humana and Cigna, major health insurance companies. He is now an advocate for healthcare reform. He's the author of Deadly Spin. He also leads the Center for Health and Democracy and the Lower Out of Pocket Now Coalition. Dr. Monica Maloof is a physician who works with Physicians for a National Health Program. Wendell and Dr. Maloof, thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. The United States is the only wealthy industrialized nation without universal health care coverage. We'll continue to cover these issues. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.